Right, it's good to be back with you all this morning, and certainly have enjoyed the weekend thus far, and looking forward to finishing off this study this weekend with two good services today, Lord willing. So, to quickly review what we've talked about so far this weekend, so Friday night we got started and kind of introduced the concepts of the fact that our beliefs don't fall in line with the mainstream world. They get attacked a lot. There's a lot of arguments that you hear of people that will try to tell us that God is not real, the Bible's not accurate, and so on. And so we said sort of what we want to focus on this weekend is, you know, what do we say in those situations, right? How do we defend our faith to others? What are some arguments we can give outside of just we believe what we believe because we believe it, or it's tradition, or whatever? What are some logical arguments that we can give? And so on Friday night, you'll remember that we talked about sort of God specifically and some arguments, evidences that point to God's existence, the miraculousness, the wonder of the creation that points to an intelligent designer, things like our sense of morality, good and evil, what is right, what is wrong, pointing to there being higher being and intelligent design behind the world. And then last night we looked more specifically at the Bible itself, and we talked about some things that help prove the Bible's accuracy, that it's not a book of fables, it's not something that was made up after the fact, you know, of making up stories that happened a long time ago, but that it is logical and it falls in line, that it really was written by, as we said, people in the first century that were there when Jesus was alive. And we talked about the harmony between all the different authors of the Bible and some of the names and tests of authenticity that the Bible books can pass to show that it was written when it said it was written, and it does stand up to some of those tests. So today, this morning, kind of continuing my part of the study from last night, I have two more points thinking about the Bible's accuracy to give us. The first one is sort of what you can call historical or archaeological accuracy, and then at the end we'll throw in a couple of scientific accuracies as well to help prove this point. So in thinking about historical or archaeological evidence, you know, one of the good things about, and you know, maybe this was part of the plan, I don't know, but about, you know, where all these biblical events took place is that most of them took place in a desert climate, right, with sand, and obviously sand is much easier to dig in than other types of land. Obviously they dig everywhere and find things everywhere, but certainly because of the nature of the land and sand, that it's easy to dig. And so in modern times, or not just in modern times, for centuries at this point, there's a lot of archaeology, a lot of digging that goes on in this area. And over again, and even to this day, they find things all the time that help prove the Bible's timeline, the events that the Bible claims to have taken place, societies of people the Bible claims to exist, have existed. And so it all, you know, kind of confirms what we know to be true in the Scriptures. So I have just, you know, a handful of examples here to give us. So we'll, you know, run down the list. I think overall I have about 10 examples to give and move through them pretty quickly and talk about how the discoveries, when they were discovered, and how they help prove the Bible's accuracy. So to start, if you want to follow along, if you want to turn to Genesis chapter 36, and look down at the end of the chapter, about verses 31 to 43. Now, for sake of time and redundancy, I'm not going to read this whole set of verses here, but you can see it there and see what it is talking about. So this is a lineage, just sort of a chronologically listing the leaders of this group of people, and it's the kings of Edom, E-D-O-M, and the Edomites. This comes off the line of Esau, you know, son of Isaac, grandson of Abraham and Sarah. The Bible, and so you can see in these verses, it's, you know, so-and-so ruled and died, And then this person reigned and died, reigned and died, reigned and died. So it gives this chronological listing here of all the leaders here. And so the Bible places these people as living on the Sinai Peninsula. So that's, you know, that little thing that juts out there in the map of the area. And, of course, I'm not an expert on timeline necessarily, but I believe it has these people living in this area about 1300 BC to 800 BC, give or take. And this was at odds for many, many years with what secular historians would tell you. They originally said for several centuries that there was no evidence of anybody having ever lived in this land that far back, that people did not live there until 300, 400, 500 years later. Well, in 2019, so again, some of these discoveries are very recent. In 2019, some digging was taking place there, and they discovered evidence. And of course, you know, I know nothing about how all this works, so I wouldn't know what I'm looking at if I had dug this up, but, you know, people are very smart and have expertise in this, so that they can tell what they're looking at and how old it is and everything else. So they discovered some samples of copper and charcoal that had been used. It wasn't in a natural state. It had been used for smelting and cooking, I assume, and things of that nature. And this dated back to 1300 BC, which was, of course, falls exactly in line with what the Bible had said for centuries at this point of when people had lived in this area. So it was at odds, and now a discovery was made that shows that, yeah, the Bible had that right. People did live there when it said they did. So to go to a second point, and there are several places in Genesis that you can find reference to this, but for instance, in Genesis 23, talking about a group of people called the Hittites, and this is a fairly big one. I remember hearing about this some as a kid. So the Hittites are a group of people that is mentioned throughout the Old Testament. You have in Genesis 23 the mention of Ephron the Hittite selling Abraham a burial ground, a grave place to bury the dead. Over a couple chapters in Genesis 26, down at verse 34, it mentions, and Esau was 40 years old when he took Judith, the daughter of Beri the Hittite, and Bashemeth, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, which were of a grief of mine unto Isaac and Rebekah. So you have Esau marrying two Hittite women, right, to the dismay of Isaac and Rebekah. And there are other places throughout the Old Testament as well that mention these Hittites. Well, yet again, there was no real evidence for a long, long time of these people having existed outside of the Scriptures. And so again, this was a place doubters could look at and point to and say, well, hey, we have all these evidences of all these other things, but these Hittites, you know, where are they? The Bible mentions them several times, claim that they were a noteworthy culture of people, yet we don't have any evidence of it. In the late 1800s, they dug up and found an Assyrian tablet. And what it was is essentially like, I guess, a receipt, as we would say today, or a log of trades that they had made with, you know, other tribes, other groups of people, right? You know, 10 pounds of whatever, or 20 pounds of, you know, whatever. And on that listing, it mentioned a trade that they had made with the Hittites. And that became the first evidence that anyone had ever discovered outside of the Scriptures that the Hittites were real and they existed as the Bible said. But then a few years later, an even greater discovery was made. In 1907, an archaeologist by the name of Hugo Winkler digging in the area, and he discovered something massive. They discovered the ruins of an old building, and in it lied thousands and thousands of tablets, you know, stone tablets with writing on it. And essentially what they had uncovered was the Hittite National Library, National Archive. It was theirs, and over again, these tablets made mention of their society, trades they had made, historical events that had happened during their society. And when you know again, and I'm going to repeat myself as I go through all these examples, again, it dated back and matched the Bible's timeline and where the Bible said these people had lived and where all this had taken place. It matched it perfectly. If you look in 2 Kings, chapter 8, again, a listing here can be found in this chapter of several kings that had ruled. So in verse 16, it says, "And in the fifth year, Jeroboam, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, and Jehoshaphat being then king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son, king of Judah, began to reign." And then down in verse 26, it mentions another king. It says, 22 years old was Ahaziah when he began to reign, and he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. Okay, so you have two kings here mentioned of the Old Testament. Something they found at some point, and I forgot to write down a date as to when they found this, but at some point they found what they call the Tel Dan stele, and stele there is S-T-E-L-E, which is a word, you know, basically meaning a stone tablet with writing on it. And this was a writing, of course, it wasn't any biblical passages or anything. It was something that somebody had made at some point. And there it mentioned these two kings. It also mentioned things about King David and sort of that lineage of people as well. And yet again, kind of the first time anyone had discovered outside of the scriptures mention of these people, and it matches the timeline of the Bible again. And so all these things tell us that these people were real people, because there's evidence outside of the scripture, there's evidence by other cultures, non-Christian cultures, right, were also writing about these things and documenting these things. So it's not a fable that was made up. These are not fake characters. These were real people that really did live and exist. If you turn back a few chapters in 2 Kings, back to chapter 3, and starting down in verse 18, so this is an account of a story here of the Israelites being at war against Mesha and the Moabs. And so we can read this here to get the story, and this says, And this is but a light thing in the sight of the Lord. He will deliver the Moabites also into your hand. And you shall smite every fenced city and every choice city, and shall fell every good tree, and stop all wells of water, and mar every good piece with land with stone. And it came to pass in the morning when the meat was offered, that behold, there came water by the way of Edom, and the country was filled with water. And when the Moabites heard that the kings were come up to fight against them, they gathered all that were able to put on armor, and upward, and stood in the border. And they rose up early in the morning, and the sun shone upon the water, and the Moabites saw the water on the other side as red as blood. And they said, "This is blood, and the kings are surely slain, and they have smitten one another. Now therefore Moab to the spoil." And when they came to the camp of Israel, the Israelites rose up and smote the Moabites. So they fled before them, and they went forward, smiting the Moabites even in their country. And they beat down the cities, and on every good piece of land cast every man his stone, and filled it. And they stopped all the wells of water, and fell all the good trees. Only in Kirasheseth left they the stones thereof, howbeit the slingers went about and smote it. And when the king of Moab saw the battle was too sore for him, he took him 700 men, drew swords to break through even unto the king of Edom, but they could not. Then they took the eldest son that should have reigned in his stead, and offered him for a burnt offering upon the wall. And there was great indignation against Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land. So you have this story, this account here of this event that had taken place. So a discovery in this that was made, a man by the name of Frederick Klein, back in 1869, discovered what they call the Moabite Stone. And it tells this story pretty exactly, but from the Moabite's perspective. See, obviously the Bible is from, you know, the Israel's perspective of things, more so, right? So it tells the other side of the story, and it matches pretty well with the stories of, you know, the destruction and all that this chapter explains. And the stone itself dates back to about 840 BC or so, which is within a decade of when the Bible timeline has this taking place. So again, it proves to us it has to be a real event that takes place, because you have two different cultures of people saying that it took place. So it's not a fable. So for our next point here, there is in the New Testament, or excuse me, the Old Testament, an earthquake that is mentioned to have taken place. And there's not a great big story about it. It's sort of just mentioned in passing, unless I've missed something. As far as I'm aware, that it's only mentioned in passing. So, for instance, in Zechariah 14 and 5, it says, "And you shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach unto Azel. Yea, ye shall flee, like as you fled from the days of the earthquake, in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and the Lord my God shall come, and all the saints with thee." There's another mention of this as well, and I think it's Amos 1 and 1, I think, mentions there being an earthquake during the reign of Uzziah. Okay, so in 2021, so again, very recently, they were doing some digging in the area, and of course there's a lot of ruins, right? It's a city that's been destroyed a time or two, right? So there's a lot of ruins and things like that. And again, I would have no idea, right? If I pulled out a ruined piece of rock, I would just see a cracked piece of rock, right? I wouldn't know anything about it, but experts can pull it out and look at it. And so in 2021, they uncovered some ruins. And I guess by whatever expertise they can look at it, they determined that it wasn't destroyed by fire or anything like that, but it had been destroyed by what you see in an earthquake, in a pretty significant earthquake. And yet again, the discovery of this and the timeline of it went back to exactly when the Bible said that earthquake would have happened and King Uzziah would have been reigning. So yet again, it matches up, and there's just a lot of evidence of the events that the Bible says happened. There's a lot of outside, objective, secular evidence that these things really did occur. So to give us a couple examples in the New Testament, I had more examples in the Old Testament, just because the Old Testament's more story-based than the New Testament, right? So, but just to give us a few, you might not think this is something that people would argue, but, you know, people have argued anything you can possibly imagine, right, in the Bible. So we know that, obviously, the Bible says that Jesus was nailed to the cross, right? Nails through the hands, through the feet. Well, people argued at times that, well, there wasn't really, I don't know how accurate that is, because there's not really evidence that the Romans ever nailed people to the cross. Instead, there's evidence that they tied people with rope to the cross. So, you know, is there a discrepancy there? Is there an inaccuracy there? So in 1967, there was what was called the Six-Day War, and Israel took control as a result of that back of the old city in East Jerusalem and some of that area. And after that, they began some excavation projects, and through the digging, they found some old graves, right? Some old little boxes of graves. And for the first time, they found, you know, bones of hands and feet with nails in them. And that was the first time that had, as far as I know, ever been discovered outside of, you know, the Bible and the place it's saying that people were nailed to the cross. But now they had proof that, yeah, that did happen, so that makes sense that could have been a real event, right? It wasn't an inaccuracy or an indiscrepancy or anything like that. In Matthew chapter 4, it's talking about Jesus is beginning his ministry here, and it mentions in verse 12, "Now when Jesus had heard that John was cast into prison, he departed into Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is upon the seacoast. So you have evidence here of Jesus being in Capernaum in the early century, right? That's what the Bible claims. And so the Capernaum, sort of a small town, and it was, as far as we know, kind of abandoned a couple centuries later, and, you know, not much happening in that area. So in the 1800s, they were doing some digging and uncovered some stuff, you know, underneath a layer of sand or whatever, an old, what appears to be a first century home, and, you know, again, dates back to the first century, and on the wall were inscriptions and references to undoubtedly Jesus and perhaps also Peter, as far as, you know, the translation's a little murky, but they think maybe Peter, but definitely Jesus for sure. So again, it shows you that this first century home dates back to the first century. They had heard of Jesus. They knew who he was. He'd probably been there. So again, it's not a story that was made up later on. These things were happening at the time, and there's evidence to prove that. So now to give a couple more examples. So we said we were going to talk about historical accuracy. There's also another side of it, the scientific accuracy of the Bible. So a lot of people, you know, will tell you that the Bible, it doesn't make any sense. And as soon as you start to question the science of it, the logic of it, you'll see all these holes and all these problems with it, and you won't be able to believe it, right? Well, we know the Bible obviously has no errors, and, you know, really a lot of these claimed errors or logical, you know, statements that the Bible makes, it's simply a result of, you know, taking things out of context, not looking at the full picture, purposely trying to twist it to make it not true, because frankly a lot of people just don't want the Bible to be true. And so we can give a couple of those today. And again, I said this last night, with any of these topics there are dozens and dozens of examples you can give. These are just a few of them to point out today. So back in Joshua, go back to the Old Testament, if I can find Joshua, there it is. Down in verse 13, there's an interesting verse here. So this chapter is in the middle of telling a story of the conquest by the Israelites of South Canaan and them moving into that area. So there's a verse here that makes a claim. So I'll tell what people say this is an example of first, of the Bible being scientifically inaccurate. But it's really not, as we'll see. So actually, I came across this one time. I was watching, I don't even really remember what, something on TV. It was some kind of historical something. And it wasn't a religious program. It wasn't about, you know, religion or anything. But someone on there mentioned in passing, they were talking about the sun revolving around the earth versus the earth revolving around the sun, right? Which one is it? And they sort of just on the offhand made this claim of, well, you know, the Old Testament claims that the sun revolves around the earth, and then, you know, the conversation went on in a different direction, but it sort of perked my ears up, because obviously we know that that's not true. The earth revolves around the sun. And obviously, knowing the Bible's free of errors, I said that, well, that can't be right. So I did some looking into it to figure out what the reference was there. And this is the verse that people talk about to, they say, proves a scientific inaccuracy of the Bible. So it says, "And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed until the people avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and has not to go down about the whole day." So it says the sun stood still. Okay, so it's hard for us maybe to imagine today, because we know this for a fact, how all this works, and, you know, we've been to outer space and we have satellites in space and everything. But once upon a time, it was the heated debate of the day was, do we revolve around the sun or does the sun revolve around us? Okay, and at that time, it is true that the Catholic Church, you know, that was the ruling power of the day during the Catholic Empire, they took the position that the sun moves around us. And they pointed to this verse and says, well, see, it says the sun stood still, so that would imply that otherwise the sun would be moving, right? obviously later on that was discovered to be not true, so you know the position changed or whatever, and people will point to that as saying, well, see, the Bible's not accurate, and you've got to scramble to try to make it fit with the evidence that we have. But really all it was is they were mistaken. And think about it. Does that verse claim that the sun revolves around the earth? Well, all it says was the sun stood still. Now, you know, how this miracle of God worked exactly, you know, I don't know. I wasn't there. But it says the sun stood still. Well, you know, we say stuff like that that's not literal all the time. What do we say every day that the sun does in the morning and the evening? We say the sun rises and the sun sets. Well, is the sun really rising and the sun really setting? No, the sun doesn't move. We move. It's from our perspective, it looks as if the sun is rising and setting because of the rotations of the earth, right? That's all it is here. The sun stood still from their perspective. However it worked, time stood still. So it's not a claim that, you know, the sun revolves around the earth. It's not a scientific inaccuracy. It's a figure of speech. You know, we talk like that all the time. You would never go up to somebody if you heard somebody say sunrise, sunset, say, well, you know, that's not accurate. You know, the sun doesn't rise, right? You wouldn't say that because we understand figures of speech, non-literal speech. And no one has a problem with that at any point outside of when it's in the Bible, right? People hold the Bible to some different standard to try to trip it up and try to prove it wrong, but it's very simply just a figure of speech. Back in Exodus 14, verse 21, so we have another example here. So this is talking about when Moses parted the Red Sea. Okay, it says, and Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea dry land, and the waters divided. Okay, so we have this story of the water passing and sort of a land bridge appearing, and then after a while that the waters come back and that disappears. So, not to in any way take away from the miracle of God here, because of course God is not bound by science. He can do whatever he wants, whether it's, you know, possible or not, and obviously it's still a fantastic miracle. The timing of it all, it could not have been done without God being involved. But, you know, it is interesting, like, okay, if you're trying to make up a story, make up a fable, it is interesting, this one part of the world, they have evidence, it's very rare, it hardly ever happens, but they do have evidence that if a strong wind from the east blows for long enough, it will happen. The waters do part there, and there is a, you know, land bridge you can walk across, and then it kind of comes back. It hardly ever happens, and certainly not probably to the extent that it happened here with the miracle of God being in hand. But again, and God can do whatever he wants, of course, whether it's possible or not. But again, if you're trying to craft some fable, trying to fool people into believing something, it's like, boy, the writers of the Bible are getting lucky over and over and over again. And of course, the reality is they're not getting lucky because it's God's word and it all happened. Right, but it is just interesting that out of all the places they could have chosen, right, to write this story, one place they say it happens, there's evidence that, yeah, that probably would be able to work if a wind blew from the east all that night and then stopped and, you know, the waters would come back. That could happen. So to give one more example in the science realm here, we have the flood. Now, there's a lot we could say, of course, about the flood. It's a heavily debated topic, right, between scientists and creationists and things like that. But to just give us one example in thinking about the flood. So there was a debate one time, it's a fairly old debate now, between a creationist and a, you know, natural scientist. And they were talking about the flood and whether there was evidence to believe that the flood really occurred. And of course the Bible timeline puts the flood at, you know, about 4,000 years ago or so, if I'm not mistaken. And what the scientist said was that we have about 16 million species today in existence. And of course we don't know the exact number, but that was what he estimated. And he said there's simply not enough time in 4,000 years. There's no way we could have gone from the amount of species that would have gotten off the ark to what we have now. There's just not enough time, is what he said. And of course, new species can come into existence, like you have your families of things, right? You have give us an example we're familiar with, like dogs, right? You have your canines, right? Your wolves, your coyotes, foxes, whatever, and then through generations of breeding or whatever, we can make new breeds, right, of dogs, all the way down to our little domesticated poodles, right, and things like that. So, and that happens naturally as well, so there's variations, and that's a different species, quote unquote, right? And so the argument is there's no way a flood could have happened 4,000 years ago and wiped everything out, because you cannot get from the few that you would have had coming off the ark to 16 million today. In fact, he said that if a flood had really happened 4,000 years ago, we should have about 5 million or so species today. So if you kind of imagine two vertical lines, we're at 16 million and we need it to be down here at 5 million. Well, we need to get this column down a little bit, right? So the counter argument to it was this. First of all, as I said, we don't know exactly how many species there are, because there's parts of the world that are not very well explored, right? The deepest depths of the ocean, deep in the Amazon rainforest. So not every single animal is documented. So it's a guess, it's an estimate. And 16 million, even among mainstream scientists, is a pretty big estimate. Most every mainstream scientist will put it more at about 11 million. Okay, so that alone lowers it. That's 5 million gone right there. But then let's think about the flood and the nature of it. Now, obviously, again, we have what we have in the Bible. I wasn't there for the flood. None of us were. So I'm not saying every one of these points necessarily is exactly how it happened, but it's just things to think about that perhaps happened, right, with the flood. So think about, of course, that he brought, as the Bible says, beast of the land right onto the ark. It doesn't really say anything about fish, right? You would think that fish, in the water and the oceans would survive, right? They didn't need to be on the ark. So fish make up, about 3 million species, and you have maybe perhaps some amphibians and things like that that could have survived off the ark too. So that brings it down a couple million. So now we're at 8.5 million. And then what about plants and seeds and things like that? Now certainly there were things brought onto the ark for food and survival, and probably some plant seeds and stuff too, but plant seeds can actually, and Darwin himself ironically enough proved this in one of his experiments, that they can stay submerged in water, even salt water, for days and months at a time, and then still have the ability to plant and sprout new species of trees or bushes or whatever. So you could take plants, perhaps, again, don't know exactly, but perhaps you could take some plant species out of that number of things that, would have been wiped out during the flood. So that can bring it down slightly further. And what about things like single cell organisms and bacteria and things like that? That makes up a huge portion of the amount of living things. And, I don't think it would have been possible for Noah to go around and gather every strand of bacteria and things like that and put it on the ark. Now, certainly some of them would have been on the ark naturally, right? They're on the animals, on the wood, whatever. But, there probably were some things that survived, and, maybe they survived on floating pieces of bark in the water and things like that. So that could bring it down even further. But then there's a big one here too. So there's something called synonymous species, which is simply a fancy word for duplicates, right? So as they discover animals, even among the same species, there's variants, right? You can have two dogs that are the exact same breed. They don't necessarily look identical, right? Weight, there's a range of weight, height, some of them even eye color, right? Some dogs have of the same breed have blue eyes, one blue eye, one black eye, right? So there's variants even amongst the same species. So as people discover things, there is a ton of times when two animals, are discovered, and they're put in the metaphorical book as two different species. But then later on, they're discovered to actually be the same species. They call that synonymous or duplicate species. And mainstream scientists, again, not even Christian apologists or anything like that, mainstream scientists estimate that anywhere between 17 to 46% of every species that we have listed may very well actually be a duplicate. There may be duplicates in there. So even if we took the very lowest number of that 17%, that brings the number of species today crashing down to 5 million, which is exactly what that scientist had said should be the case had a flood really occurred. So, you know, there you go again. Maybe it's not so illogical to think that these Bible stories really happened. And, you know, as I said, there are other examples you could give, just to give a couple rapid-fire ones to leave us with. Thinking about the flood, too, look at the dimensions of the ship that God instructed Noah to build. That matches pretty exactly ships that they make, like, in modern times for the military and things like that. God had that knowledge long before any sort of modern building, you know, schematics or anything like that, and it matches. There's also things like, there's verses in the Old Testament that talk about the earth being suspended in air and hanging on nothing in space, and a lot of ancient cultures had, you know, traditions or superstitions that the earth rested on something. You know, it had something that it sat on. The Bible, long before anybody else knew, it hangs in space. Blood being the source of life is also in the Bible, and needing blood to live. And, you know, there was a time in medicine when they thought if you were sick, it was because your blood was bad. So they'd cut you and let you bleed out all your bad blood, is what they thought. And then, you know, I guess eventually they discovered that, you know, boy, every time we're doing that, people are just dying even faster. You know, so then they made the change. But the Bible knew it long before anybody else. Blood is the key to life. There's characteristics of the ocean floors and the amount of stars that we have, and all of them match the evidence that we have around us even today, 2,000, and in the case of some of the Old Testament, even longer than that, years later, despite what people will tell you, it still stands the test of time. It still stands to these tests and evidences. It's not the case that if you simply just read the Bible, you'll see all these errors and you won't believe anymore. That's not the case. That's not the case at all. So to think about what we've talked about this weekend, and obviously we have one more lesson in this series, but this is the end of my part of this study. So we've talked about a lot of things that help argue against the mainstream arguments that we hear, to help defend our faith and prove, you know, thinking the last two nights sort of about the Bible and its accuracy. Sort of what we have, you know, through all this is thinking of it as like, obviously, we know the Bible is true, and we know all of it's true, but thinking of it from a purely, like, secular standpoint, there's evidence, really undoubtedly, that page after page after page of the Bible is accurate and true. So really, all you can kind of hang on is, and even like Jesus himself, no one doubts that Jesus lived. There's too much evidence that he did. Even the most atheistic historians will tell you that, yeah, there was a real man called Jesus who lived in the first century and was killed by the Romans. There's too much evidence of that. So the only part that you can really try to deny is that, well, okay, he lived, but he wasn't the Son of God and he didn't rise from the dead. But here's the thing, as we think about all these pages that are so accurate and so true, and I mentioned this a little bit last night, what motivation would Jesus himself, or then the apostles and the followers that followed and the generations to follow that, you know, wrote the Bible or tried to spread the Bible after that, what motivation would they have had to make up that one part of the story? They didn't gain anything from it in a physical sense during their life. They lost so much from it. They were hated by the Romans, the Jews. They had enemies and multiple directions. They were on the run from the law. They were persecuted, most of them killed. They suffered for it. And, you know, I've heard it said before, and it's true, you know, like, we as human beings, we don't lie or make something up to get ourselves into trouble. We make stuff up to get ourselves out of trouble, save our skin. We don't purposely, you know, make stuff up. Like, you would have to paint some picture in a story, like people will say, okay, so there's even, you know, evidence most people will accept too, that they found Christ's grave empty. But what some people say is, well, you know what it probably was? It was probably some of the disciples. They snuck in, you know, and stole the body and stole the grave to, but to do what? So they got together and came up with this plan that, hey, we should, you know, risk getting caught and risk, you know, life in a brutal prison and probably crucifixion to steal his body so we can keep this fairy tale going of, oh, he rose from the dead. But to gain what? To then be hated by most of society and be on the run and be persecuted and arrested and stoned and all these other things? It just doesn't make sense. There's, to me, no other conclusion that you can realistically come to other than these things are real and Christ is real and he did die on the cross for our sins and we must follow after him. So can think about that and hopefully that'll motivate us all. You know, as I said last night, the truth is in our hands. We have to carry it on and fight for it. And hopefully these things that we've talked about this weekend and we'll talk about this afternoon will not only help us to be better prepared to have conversations with people out in the society, but also remind us and motivate us that we're following the truth and this is the truth and there's evidence after evidence to suggest that. And we have to follow after it because we know that, as Christ said, he's the only way to life. There is no other way to life other than through him. And I hope we'll all think about that every day that we live and carry it on and fight for the truth and his true gospel and his true church and be prepared, as it said in Peter there, to give an answer to every man that asks us why we have the hope that we have, to give an answer and to be able to defend it. And as I said, it's a skill that I need to get better at and probably a lot of us could stand to get better at it. So hopefully we will and to be able to defend our faith. And, you know, it's a tough battle, as I've said, right? I said that last night. We get attacked today more than we ever have before in our culture for believing what we believe, but we must stand up for it and fight for it. Because as we've seen, there's so many things that prove it's not a book of fables. It's not merely tradition. It's real and it's true. And there's reason to believe that. So again, I thank you for your attention this tonight, today and last night, and I'm very happy to have been able to do this with you this weekend, and I hope we'll all benefit from it. So as we turn it back over to the song service, again, we'll make the call of invitation. If any of you have spiritual needs to be baptized into the truth or to get back on the path of the straight and narrow or whatever it may be, we invite you to come forward as we sing the song.